League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Milwaukee Journal sent the Milwaukee Brewers podcast coming at you once again. Got another interview for you, another interesting look back at a year in Brewers history. We've done a few of these episodes. We've looked back at 2008, 2011, 1987, and 1981. Now we're going to try with 1978. We're going to go all the way back to the first really great Brewers season. 1978, the Brewers won 93 games, finished third in the American League East, so didn't really sniff a playoff spot despite having such a breakthrough. But this was the first winning season in Brewers history, so there's a lot to unpack. They went from, you know, a complete also-ran to one of the top teams in the American League, and in fact would have won the AL West that year. The AL West champion Royals only had 92 wins, so the Brewers were one game better. They were among the best teams in baseball, and so the Brewers made some changes that really seemed to set the franchise in motion on a positive direction. My name is J.R. Radcliffe, host of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel Brewers podcast, and my guest today is Larry Heisel. He was a free agent signing back in 1978 from the Minnesota Twins, an all-star who came to the Brewers and continued his all-star ways. I mean, he was tremendous in 1978, an incredible season, which was notable for a lot of other reasons. And so I really wanted to talk to him about the free agency process, which was different then. There was sort of a short-lived system in which players could go to another team, but they couldn't go to just any team. There had to be a certain number of teams had to sort of put in a waiver claim of sorts, a claim to just even be able to negotiate, and only a certain number of teams could even get into the bargaining. So that was something that players ultimately got rid of when they went on strike in the 1981 season, or I should say, no, that's right, the 1981 season. Talked about that with Raleigh Fingers, and then the system more closely resembled what we have today. But back in 1978, Larry Heisel, and you'll hear him tell me, wanted to stay with the Minnesota Twins, but didn't quite work out, and he winds up in Milwaukee, and it's here that's, first of all, a huge free agent signing for the Milwaukee Brewers. It really put them on the map. He comes in, he has a great year, a 906 OPS. He hits 34 home runs, drives in 115 runs. He is third in the MVP voting that year. But there are a lot of other new things about the Brewers in 1978 that helped that team get over the hump. First of all, you've got Harry Dalton, general manager, and George Bamberger as manager. Both had come from the Orioles. They were still early in their tenure with the Brewers and reshaping what Milwaukee baseball was all about. Rookie Paul Molitor was on the team. He ends up finishing second place in the Rookie of the Year voting. That's his rookie year, 1978, 21 years old. Robin Yount, still just 22 years old. He's a veteran at this point, but still just 22 years old on this team. They also traded from Detroit, got Ben Ogilvy, an outfielder who wasn't necessarily one of the top players on this year's team, in the 78 team, although he had a fine year. He was an 867 OPS guy, 303 batting average, wasn't necessarily one of the regular starters, but saw action in 128 games. He, of course, winds up being a big piece of the early 80s teams, but also Mike Caldwell has his best season. I mean, he is unstoppable. He's a 22-9 pitcher that year, 2.36 ERA, second in the Cy Young voting, just awesome. And they did have a couple other pitchers. Larry Sorensen had a very good year. Some relief pitchers. Bob McClure was there. Bill Castro, who I know a lot of Brewers fans know, the longtime bullpen coach for the Milwaukee Brewers. He had a 1.81 ERA that year, so he was very good. But Caldwell was where it was at. I mean, and he's a big part of the 1982 team as well. But he really gets things started in 1978. He actually finishes, gets some MVP votes as well. Finishes behind only Ron Guidry of the New York Yankees for the Cy Young voting. full disclosure there. I mean, Ron Guidry got all the first place votes. He was the runaway winner of that award. But we do talk about Ron Guidry a little bit, nicknamed Louisiana Lightning. He and the New York Yankees were a formidable opponent for the Brewers when it came to the AL East standings. But the Brewers really did kind of get the best of those Yankees during the 78 season, and Mike Caldwell was a big reason why. So this is an interesting year to me. It's a little bit before my time. I think it is a little bit before... I would say the 1981-82 teams are most on the radar for Brewers fans when they look back in history because those teams made the playoffs. And I don't think the Bambi's Bombers teams of 78 and 79 really get a whole lot of attention because those teams didn't end up going to the playoffs. They won a ton of games. In fact, the 79 team actually won more games than the 78 team. The 79 team finished with 95 wins, second in the AL East, but just as far out of a playoff spot because of the number of great teams that they had to go against. And in that case, it was the Baltimore Orioles, the great Baltimore Orioles teams of the late 70s, early 80s. Brewers finished 8 games out in 1979 of a playoff spot. In 1978, I believe they were 7 games out. So they definitely, they weren't really in the conversation despite having some of the best teams in franchise history. Larry Heisel was a huge piece of it. Coming over as a free agent really put them on the map, like I said, and then went ahead and had a tremendous season. Injuries completely short-circuited what he was able to do after that. He fell off the map in terms of contribution simply because he had injuries. He couldn't really sustain the success that he had. He was out of the organization pretty quickly thereafter. Did end up then becoming a longtime employee of the Milwaukee Brewers. Still works for them, in fact. Has been director, the guy really who sort of runs the Milwaukee Brewers youth outreach program in the inner cities of inner city Milwaukee in particular. He's been hugely involved with stuff like that for the last the last 20 years. So it's been he's somebody who's been around Brewers baseball a long time. He's a joy to talk to. And really liked going back in time with him to revisit this season that, I do feel like kind of gets lost in the history of Brewers baseball. So without further ado, here is Larry Heisel talking about the 1978 Milwaukee Brewers. My guest is Larry Heisel, a longtime member of the Milwaukee Brewers organization in some capacity. First came to the Milwaukee Brewers in 1978 when he signed as a free agent, really the first big free agent signing in Milwaukee Brewers history. So Larry, that's where we're going to start. I want to ask a lot of questions about the year 1978. It's a year I think a lot of Brewers fans sort of forget about. But for starters, the free agency process was very different back then. And I kind of just want to hear in your own words how it worked out for you. You know, I know the Rangers were interested in you and the Brewers were interested in you. But there's also, it was just different machinations then. Can you kind of just describe what you remember from that time and how you ultimately ended up in Milwaukee?
Free agency was at its infancy, just beginning to a degree that every week most of the major newspapers would list the free agents and how they performed that week. And we were constantly analyzed and watched. So there was a lot of added pressure. It was a very interesting process. Back then, you could only negotiate with teams that were allowed to choose you. And there was only 13 teams that could choose a player, and then you had to negotiate with those 13. And in all honesty, I wanted to stay in Minnesota. My wife and I fell in love with the city. Bloomington, to this day, is one of my all-time favorite cities. Plus, Minnesota, we had a very, very good offensive team. And I had fallen in love with those players. And when you're in a lineup with Carew and Lyman Bostock, you need no one else. And it was a difficult choice, but, you know, one that I felt it was probably best that, you know, I look elsewhere and see what was available.
So the Brewers have a new GM, a new coach, a new manager, I should say. Harry Dalton and George Bamberger are kind of new to the scene. They'd been in Baltimore. I'm kind of curious what your initial impressions were of them, and if they played a big role in you deciding to come to Milwaukee. I know you were had been teammates in Philadelphia with Don Money, so maybe that played a role, or just staying in the Midwest maybe played a role. What were some of the factors you were considering?
All of the above.
Sure.
Plus about 10 more. The city reminded me a great deal of Minnesota, Milwaukee did in the Midwest. The team, I felt, was similar, but I also felt that there was a nucleus of players in Milwaukee better than in Minnesota. When you have the likes of Cecil Cooper there and Yount, and Sixto Lozcano was there, Gantner, Gorman Thomas, Caldwell, I realized that there was not a lot missing from that organization that would propel them into a competitive team. Even though they were in the most difficult division to win, that American League East with, my goodness, the three killers, Baltimore, New York, and Boston. But I just felt that with the right mixture of new players, also my first year was Paul Molitor's first year.
Right.
Ben Ogilvie came over, and it was an experience of a lifetime for me. I think we grew, we improved, we became extremely competitive, and it forever will be etched in my mind as the most memorable year of my career. 1978, we finished in third place, American League East, only three teams in the entire baseball had better records than us. And our only problem was two was in our division. the Yankees and Baltimore. But it was a thrill. Every game was like, in that division, was like playing an all-star game. Detroit that year won 86 games, and they certainly was no pushover. So you realize that when you played against New York, Boston, Baltimore, Detroit, you had to be at your best. If not, the outcome would not be one of your liking.
I'm kind of putting the cart before the horse here, but you kind of bring it up that you guys were a very good team, obviously, and still only able to take third in the AL East because of how stacked it was. When you got to the end of the season, was it a disappointment because the Brewers weren't able to contend for a playoff spot? Because on the other hand, this is Milwaukee's first truly competitive team, the first winning team. I have to think there's also a ton of optimism for what's ahead. How did players look at it after the 78 season?
Extremely excited. The year before, the Milwaukee Brewers lost 96 ball games.
Right, yeah.
And I don't think anyone expected us to perform the way we did. And when we finished that season, even though we didn't make it to the playoff, we realized that the way we competed with teams in our division, and back then, you played teams in your division more than teams out of the division. Baltimore, Boston, we played them 15 times. Hmm. So if you weren't ready to perform, I mean, it would be a horrible, horrible year. And like I mentioned, of all the teams in baseball, we finished with the fourth best record. And we honestly believed that we could compete with any team. You give us up a 5-6 game series, because even with the Yankees that year, who went on to win the World Series, and again, I have these things etched in my brain, I'm almost certain we beat them of the 15 games, 10. And they have all-stars at every position. Not only position players, but, you know, names that will be remembered as long as the game is played. One of my all-time favorite players who graduated with me the same year from high school in Ohio, different city, Mr. Thurman Munson.
Sure.
One of the all-time greats. And, you know, Chambliss, Reggie Jackson, Paul Blair, Nettles, Pinella, Rivers, Roy White. And that's
not,
just
not
the
to mention
players.
Louisiana Lightning on the mound, too, who I think finished second in the MVP voting that year. So they had it on all sides.
I know. And see, pitchers, I'm not going to mention. They give me more headaches. As a matter of fact, to this day, I still get headaches thinking about them. But you're right. And, you know, Ron Guidry had a year unlike I'd ever seen before or after. I believe he was like 27-3. I have never seen a pitcher make so many great pitches when needed. I always believed as a hitter, what I relied on was pitchers making mistakes. Didn't have to be a huge mistake, didn't have to be a curveball that landed right over the middle of the plate. If they were trying to throw a fastball inside, if they missed 2 inches, that was enough to give me a chance to hit. Guidry, my goodness, rarely ever missed. And I had never seen anything like that. And if you're lucky enough to get by Guidry, back then relief pitchers pitched 3 innings.
Sure.
You know, the 7th, 8th, and 9th inning, you had Mr. Gossage, which was equally difficult to contend with. So it was a challenge, but an honor and a thrill, because when you competed against them and you did well, you knew that you could repeat that against any other team in the league.
So if I'm right, Guidry, I think, took second in the MVP voting, won the Cy Young that year, but then you took third in the MVP voting that year. And I know you'd had a tremendous season your last year with the Twins in 77. Seems like injuries were really the story for you going in the early part of your career. It seemed like you were really snake bitten with injuries and then really break out 77, 78. Was that all it was? Was you just felt like you were healthy at that point, or was there more to it?
I felt that 78, 77 were years that if I could have written down a script for me to follow, it wouldn't have been better than what took place. I was never prouder of myself in my life. But even the year before, 76, I drove in 98 runs with Minnesota, hit, I think, almost 290-something and stole 32 bases. So I was just year after year getting better and better and better. And clearly what put me over the edge was my confidence. I had regained the confidence that is necessary to succeed. To the degree I tell my friends and the kids that I watch play today, if I owned a major league team, every player in the minor leagues would take a sports psychology course in spring training taught by sports psychologists that I would hire. I think it is that important. But that was the key, you know, to my success. Plus, there was a player that I learned as much from who was younger than me than any player in my entire career. And I played with some of the best ever. When I began, Dick Allen with Philadelphia, who was as good as anyone. I go to Minnesota and there's Harmon Killebrew, Tony Oliva, Rod Carew, Bert Blylevin. But there was a player who came near the end, Lyman Bostock, who had a will to succeed unlike I had ever witnessed before or after. Every second of the day was designed for him to get better. When he came to play, if you didn't give 100%, he would embarrass you because he played so hard and wanted to win so much. And I felt that I had really worked hard to develop psychologically, but he helped me in so many ways. And we used to joke around a lot about how we would prepare for games. And I'll never forget one game. Lyman was taking batting practice, and I would joke around with him. And after he hit, I said, "Lyman, listen. I said, that's the best swing I've ever seen. When we go in after batting practice, start preparing for your post-game interview with the press, because you're clearly going to be the star of the game." But he was just a marvelous, marvelous player. And what he taught me, most of all, other than you have to be just mentally prepared every pitch, is that that preparation is not only for you, but for every one of your teammates. Lyman was the greatest leader I've ever seen. Not big in clubhouse meetings and screaming at players and criticizing mistakes, but just the way he went about his game made you want to play harder. And I said, that's what I have to do. I thought and hoped I had done that before, but I said, I'm going to take that to a higher level. And when I came to Milwaukee, that's what I tried to do. In meetings, never would scream or holler at anyone. I'd walk over and, you know, let people know, you know, maybe if that same play happens tomorrow, the next day, try A or B or C. And it was like a miracle. It was like a miracle. But so much had happened. And those 2 years, I remember when the season ended with Milwaukee, we flew back from California. And that next day, I start thinking about 79, working on what I wanted to achieve statistically. Normally, I would wait until after Thanksgiving to start preparing for the season. I took 2 weeks off, and I was working out. And I wanted 79 to be the best year I have ever had. And I knew it would take a lot of work. But it didn't happen. I'm haunted to this day about the way things turned out. But when I look at the whole picture, I'm also lucky that I was able to play as long as I did.
That it breaks my heart, because I think everybody kind of knows 79, the injuries come back, and I think it's a rotator cuff and keeps you, really short circuits your baseball career. I'm guessing a lot of people come up to you similar to how they approach Raleigh Fingers when they're talking about the 82 season, like, "Oh, if only you'd been healthy." I'm guessing you hear that a lot from people around the Brewers organization. "If only you'd been healthy, Larry, 1979, 80, all of that, it would have been amazing."
Oh, it would have been a joy for me and a privilege to have been able to play. You know, I tried to watch the team as much as I could. It was tough. It was tough. Not being able to play the game that you love as much as anyone who's ever played. Many games I couldn't watch. Matter of fact, almost all of them I couldn't watch. It was that difficult. I wish I could have played my son, who at the time was 8 years old. I'll never forget. He said, "Dad, if you would have been on the Brewers, we would have won the World Series." And I thanked him. And I thought to myself, if I was on the Brewers, we may not have gotten to the World Series. I could have been that bad. But it would have been a privilege to have played. It would have been a privilege. I still see the Cardinals to this day. Their players, their specifically their pitchers, and most of the pitchers that did well against the Brewers were the type that I didn't mind facing, the hard-throwing pitchers with great sliders. So it would have been a challenge, but one that I would have happily accepted.
Yeah. And I don't know if in the 79 team, I think won two more games than the 78 team. Bambi's Bombers were in full effect both of those seasons. I think George Bamberger gets forgotten a little bit in Brewers lore because those Brewers teams weren't, you know, in that format, just weren't able to go to the playoffs. And my colleague Tom Haudricourt and I have talked about why he's not on the Walk of Fame outside of Miller Park, that, you know, he has a team name nicknamed after him. What was George Bamberger like? What was your relationship with him? And can you kind of describe him to someone who may not know a lot about him?
George was a manager unlike any other He had played the game a long time, was a pitching coach for a long time, and then transcended into a manager. And I believe what he did best was his understanding of players. He allowed you to go out there and perform. You knew what you had to do, and you went out there and did it. He was, again, knowledgeable, intelligent, funny, and everyone loved him. Everyone loved him. We would have run through the wall for George. Most managers, what you want is for them to never lose games for you. I believe that a manager could lose four or five games based on decisions. George, we knew, would always make that right decision. And whether or not we always would win or lose would be because how we performed out on the field, not by a decision George would make. So we had a man who, my goodness, deserves to be on that Walk of Fame as much as any player or coach or anyone else has ever been placed up there.
Some of the other players you've already mentioned that were on that team, Ben Ogilvie, that's his first year with the Brewers. He was acquired from Detroit, and he obviously ended up playing a big role in the Brewers over the next several years. Paul Molitor, I believe, takes second in the Rookie of the Year voting. Mike Caldwell, second in Cy Young that year. Another underrated player in Brewers history, I would say, had a tremendous year in 1978. I do want to ask about Molitor, though, and kind of what your initial impressions were of him. He's 21 years old, and your careers kind of intersect at other points. I mean, you're the hitting coach in Toronto in 93 when he's there winning the World Series, and he's obviously a Minnesota guy, and you had some time in Minnesota as well. So I'm guessing you guys had a lot to talk about, at the very least. What did you think of him as a rookie back then?
I remember when I signed with the Brewers, one of my first things that I had to do was get Paul Molitor's telephone number. Playing for the University of Minnesota, they had a wonderful indoor facility that they would allow me to practice at. And I'll never forget, the coach said, "Larry, you have to do only one thing." I said, "What's that?" He said, "Talk to my players when they ask." I said, "I'd be honored." And it was such a joy. I would take my son, who at that time was probably about, he'd been 5 years old, four and five, and we'd go and work out. And that's how I met Paul. And after I signed, I remember calling Paul, and he talked about it even when I coached him in Toronto. He said that was one of the biggest thrills of his life. He said, "The RBI leader giving me a call." But it was a thrill for me because I had watched him play. After our first workout together, I'll never forget this, I came home and called Bud Selig. And I said, "Bud, I don't know who Milwaukee has that is etched in concrete other than Yount and Cooper to play the infield positions. But I said, this young man, I think, is going to give someone a lot of problems. He can play." And never have I witnessed a rookie come into the game with so much knowledge and perform so consistently from the beginning of the season till the end as Paul Molitor. I remember I tell my friends this story. We were in Minnesota, and after one of the games, we're outside the locker room, and his mother and father was there, and his mother walked over to me. And she said, "Larry, could I ask a favor?" I said, "Certainly, anything." She said, "Please help Paul out. Give him advice." I said, "Oh, certainly, no problem. I'd be happy to." And I told my friends, I said, honestly, within 2 weeks later, I was going to Paul for advice. He was just so consistent and such a wonderful player from day one. And one of my all-time favorites. My goodness, as nice a player as he is great. And back then, unlike today, you could bring people into the clubhouse. You travel around the country, and everywhere you go, there's normally people you know. And every once in a while, they'd like to bring their children to clubhouse. You have to be careful because we had some players, great teammates, but took losses and bad performances not the best. And it would carry over to the next day. So there's certain players I knew I couldn't have the kids around. But Paul Molitor, it never happened. But if Paul would have struck out four times in a game with the bases loaded each time, the next day I could have brought my son to him. And Paul would have treated my son like he was his son and like he had gone 4 for 4. He was that type of person. And again, not one of my all-time favorite players, but one of my all-time favorite people to be around.
Yeah, there weren't many occasions when Paul Molitor struck out four times in a row anyway, so probably just as well. You said you were talking about players who maybe were a little grumpy the next day, and my head initially flashed the word Gorman. I am probably completely unfair, but I know he was a character on that team too.
Mr. Thomas, Mr. Gorman
Mr. Thomas,
one of a kind. Gorman,
definitely.
When he's 94 years old, he'll be the same as when he played. Jovial, joking around, and, you know, like everyone. You know, Gorman took his trade extremely seriously, and he wouldn't like bad performances. And sometimes when he would strike out, he would maybe throw a helmet or or break a bat. But we realized that was his way to get prepared for that next at bat. So it wasn't a big deal. And he wasn't by himself. There were a lot of players. The one thing about this game, when I started to coach, I told every young kid, some of your greatest memories in life will come because of what you do on that baseball field. But also some of your worst memories in life will be because of what you do on that field. And what you're going to have to do is be able to just learn how to accept what's bad, learn from it, and come back that next day with more determination than ever before. And that's how you succeed, because we're all going to fail. It's just a part of the game. But, you know, Gorman was a wonderful teammate and, my goodness, played a huge, huge part in the Brewers' success as an organization.
Yeah, also one of the most popular players in Brewers history right there, Gorman Thomas. And I do want to ask real quick about Caldwell. He had, like I said, a great year that year, 22 wins, I want to say. And again, a player that we don't really talk about him as much anymore. And I mean, it's a lot of players will. I think he's probably been back to Miller Park a time or two here, but he's just not a guy that gets brought up when we talk about the greats in Milwaukee Brewers history. And he was a unique type of pitcher, left-hander, and obviously he stayed with the team for a while. Was pitcher in Game 1 of the World Series even in 1982. But what do you remember about Mike Caldwell?
Mike not only surprised me, but I think he surprised everyone in 1978. You know, I had faced Mike, and Mike, left-handed pitcher, like you mentioned, threw a hard sinking fastball. But that year in 78, Mike threw harder and the ball had more sink. There were games, and specifically some games against the Yankees, that he pitched that will go down in Brewer history as some of the best pitch games you could ever want to see. I mean, he just dominated the Yankees. And the Yankees, my goodness, all-star at every position. I felt sorry for pitchers when they had to face the Yankees, because they had a lineup that were comprised of, honestly, almost an all-star at every position. And right. If you weren't at your best, if you weren't hitting spots, mixing pitches well, you would have a horrible, horrible game. But Mike went out there just time after time and dominated the pitchers. And also, he had that tenacity about him that made him want to go out there and be the best. And that year, we knew that every time we went out there, towed that mound, we had an excellent chance of winning. And like you mentioned, Mike, I think, doesn't receive the true credit that he deserves, but he had a year that I think is going to be difficult to match by many pitchers in Brewer history.
Yeah, definitely. I want to get off the beaten path a little bit. I've got a couple more questions for you, but you're sort of famously the first designated hitter in baseball history back a few years before your time with the Brewers. I wonder how you feel about the DH today. Do you feel like it's good for baseball? Because that conversation comes up a lot of talk about maybe doing away with it at some point. What do you think? Do you fall one way or the other on that?
You know, I do have an opinion. Probably not one that the fans will like to hear. Being old-fashioned, I started in the National League and began with a manager who I felt, as did many others, was the most brilliant mind in the history of the game, Gene Mauch. It was an honor and a privilege to play for Gene. Oftentimes, no, more than often, 99.9% of the times when the manager would run out to argue with an umpire, it would be just to oftentimes stall or try to get the team motivated. But when Gene went out there, umpires were afraid. And if I didn't see it, and the reason they were afraid, and if I didn't read this, and didn't see it, I wouldn't believe it. But there were more rule changes because of Gene's knowledge of the rules than anyone. And there had to be at least, I read somewhere, 7 or 8 rule changes because of Gene's knowledge. And one I'm well aware of, there was a foul ball hit into our dugout, and the catcher ran over. It was real high, and he came in the dugout. Gene Mauch pushed him. He couldn't catch the ball, and opposing umpire ran over and talking to the umpires. They huddled. Gene went out. He talked to them. They huddled again, and the ruling was no catch, and the rule book, there was no rule in there that you could not interfere. No, there was no interference if a player came into dugout. Now, the next year, that rule was changed. But Gene made it such a joy to show up every day. And part of that joy was having that pitcher in that lineup, because there were so many strategies that you could use. And without that, it takes away a lot, I think, from the real basic part of the game. But from a fan standpoint, I mean, clearly having DH, there'll be more hits, there'll be more runs scored, and they'll love it more. But if I had my choice of watching a game, one where the score is 18-14 or 1-0, give me that 1-0. I grew up in the era of Mr. Bob Gibson, Mr. Sandy Koufax, Nolan Ryan. And I love a well-pitched game. So if I had my choice, I'd have to leave the DH out for a while. But again, I'm happy I don't have a choice, because I'm quite sure the fans would be extremely upset.
Oh, I don't know. There's a couple factions. I definitely am fine with DH making it universal, which I think is the direction we're ultimately headed, but maybe not for a while. I don't know. We'll see. Before I let you go, I want to get a little sense of what it is you do now for the Milwaukee Brewers. I know you've spent a long part of your career here working with youth baseball in Milwaukee, and really, I believe a lot of the community outreach stuff with the Brewers has kind of been your department. So what is it that you're doing right now?
You know, my title with the Brewers is manager of youth outreach, and it's comprised of everything. My wife, who knows me better than anyone, will be married for 50 years in September. She reminds me about once every 6 months. She says, "Larry, you were not born to play baseball. No, you were born to help children in need." And she says that because she says no one understands their plight better than you. I was an orphan when I was 10, extremely poor. I lived with a lady who was on welfare. My father became ill when I was a little older than six, never to be in my life again. My mother passed away when I was 10, had no brothers or sisters, and it was a tough ordeal. And she's right. When I go work with children, whether they're in a detention center, single parent home, school setting, even kids in the suburbs, no matter what they're experiencing, I've gone through it. And I can help them through those real, real, real tough times. Also, I deal with children that are experiencing some of the most difficult challenges medically. And I have memories because of these children that will last me a lifetime. You know, one of my favorite stories, there was a young boy, his name is Anthony, who passed away from cancer. And he was almost 12 years old. I have never worked with a kid who liked me more than Anthony. His mother had to take his phone away because he would call me so much. And I went to visit him once at Children's Hospital, and just he and I was in the room, and the oncologist came in with a new assistant. And the oncologist knew me. He said to Anthony, he said, "Anthony, introduce your friend to my new assistant." Anthony looked over at me and said, "That's my father." And Anthony went on to explain why he made that statement. And it was the greatest compliment of my life. And I tell people a sort of ironic twist about it, what made it so different. Anthony was white, and when he made that statement, that assistant looked at me really strange, but it was the greatest thrill and honor I've ever received for this young boy who was white to think of me as his father. And when I work with kids, I try to leave an impression on them, or make the impression to a degree, that when there's a decision that has to be made, a really tough decision, I want them to think about me, and hopefully helping them be guided in the right direction for that decision-making process. You know, I tell the Brewers that I'm really fortunate that they're giving me a chance to continue my passion. And for every day that I work, I'll be considered the luckiest man ever to grace this earth.
He is Larry Heisel. He was, as you all know by now, the big free agent signing in 1978 and a longtime member of the Milwaukee Brewers organization. Larry, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate you taking the time. And obviously, with the way things are right now, it's customary now to say stay safe, stay healthy. But so I certainly wish that for you. And thank you so much for joining me on the Brewers podcast.
It's my pleasure. Anytime, anytime.
That is what we have for you this week. Next week, it's another interview with the one and only Tom Hodricourt, Brewers beat reporter of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We have a little bit of fun. We talked briefly about the Walk of Fame and how difficult it is for anybody to get elected to that thing. The sort of, I guess, Hall of Fame equivalent outside of Miller Park, kind of etched into the concrete of the walkways around Miller Park. We haven't seen very many people added to the list of Walk of Fame inductees, so to speak, lately, and that's always been a little frustrating to Tom Hodricourt, myself as well. I feel like there's a few guys out there who deserve to be mentioned. So we'll give you an interview, a conversation next week where we go in depth the guys that we think belong on that list, guys who for some reason just haven't been, maybe why they haven't been to this point, and we take a little bit of a deep dive on that and have quite a bit of fun. So that's something to look forward to next week. After that, not sure where we're headed, but as always, with baseball on hiatus, we don't know exactly where it's headed. Of course, some rumblings early this week that we might see baseball in early July if a plan by the owners is approved. A lot of hurdles to go before that comes to fruition. Does not sound like the financial logistics are something that the Players Association will agree to at this point, but at least it gives a little bit of optimism that we could have baseball in July and maybe half a season, an 82-game season or something close to that. A lot of interesting particulars there. I think if that does end up becoming more of a reality, we can obviously talk more about that and how that would impact the Milwaukee Brewers specifically. So that is something for the future. Hopefully we'll get back towards sports and, regular normal life sometime soon. And in the meantime, we will keep bringing you what we can here on the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel Brewers podcast. Thanks for tuning in this week. My name is J.R. Radcliffe. Find me on Twitter at J.R. Radcliffe. That's J.R.R.A.D.C.L.I.F.F.E. Let me know what you think. Rating and review on Apple Podcasts, always helpful. Find us on Stitcher and Spotify as well. Take care.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at lower.com field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at columbuscrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.